are you gonna do?
I wanna do like a in-depth like look at the Huey.
Sure.
And the Cobra.
Yeah, yeah, that's fine. Right. Huge technological advance. That's fine.
Usual participation for this class.
You aren't in the hall, so I didn't close the door on you.
Sorry.
I looked. I looked first.
You did.
Talking about Tet. Tet was definitely a huge, significant event that essentially guaranteed that LBJ was not going to be able to run for another term as President of the United States. But we have to look at Tet fairly. First, in launching the Tet operations, because of the sheer scale of what took place, again, like we said, 80,000 troops attacking 36 of the major 64 cities, plus 50 hamlets, and they were all over the place. The problem was, is because it was so big, they were unable to coordinate the scale of the operation. So as a result, they failed to not only prevent premature assaults, essentially allowing the Americans to know something was going on, but they also underestimated U.S. mobility and firepower. The most elite VC units were ordered to go in and hold the cities, but the problem was, is in the cities, that's where the Americans could respond greatest. So essentially, the elite units were almost mostly wiped out. And, shockingly, the ARVN actually responded strongly, fiercely. Which was really the first time in the war that they had done so. And they also underestimated the mood of the population. Tet was a spiritual and religious holiday. And the North Vietnamese chose Tet to launch a massive attack. And that really didn't work out. And by the way, that's also why the Tet Offensive ended up being a loss. And the casualties were huge. They lost approximately 65,000 men out of the 80,000. That they had mobilized for the Tet Offensive. And of course, these numbers include killed or who were injured or had become captured. Plus, you got to sprinkle in how many troops they lost at Khe Sanh, which I did talk about, it's on the recording. Technically, this makes it the worst military operation of the war. But FYI, I should note, casualties were high on both sides. The U.S., the ARV, and the Allies, they suffered about 45,000 casualties. Plus another 35,000 civilian casualties, and there were approximately 600,000 people that fled the villages, fled to the cities, creating a huge refugee crisis. And the fighting was intense. Again, I shared the story of my father's experience during the middle of the Tet. Spent several days inside the tank, hearing the plink, 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 plink. And the guys inside basically firing every single bullet they had. And they did engage in close quarters, stabby type fighting. It was crazy. And the worst site of the fighting was in the ancient capital of Vietnam, Hue. U.S. and ARVN forces fought for 25 days, going street to street. Yes, during the battle, the Americans and the ARVN were able to eventually drive the VC out, but while the VC held the city, they actually rounded up and assassinated over 3,000 government officials, tied them up, made them kneel on the ground, and put a bullet in the back of their head. And then they dumped their bodies in mass graves. And devastation. Buildings that had been standing for hundreds of years were blown up. And also, because a lot of the fighting was in the cities, there actually was press there. Of course, the most famous image of the Tet Offensive was when General Nguyen Ngoc Lon, who was the chief of the National Police, shot a VC right in the head with his sidearm. If you look up Tet, chances are that's the image that's going to come up. You see the South Vietnamese official with his sidearm, gun here, and you see the VC at the moment he gets shot, his face looking like, ugh. But there were also stories. The press was there. They filmed it. It was broadcast to the world. Of course, I don't remember what's in this video clip. I don't think I watched it. I watched most of them before I get to them. I don't think I did this one. Hopefully it still works. Come on, internets. Here we go. Oh, there we go. That's the image I was talking about. Oh, it just went away. Maybe it will be at the end. God, this is so painful. At least we didn't have to watch commercials. All right, let's see what we got going on this video.
Hello and welcome to History Pod. On the 1st of February 1968, American photojournalist Eddie Adams took a photograph of South Vietnamese National Police Chief General Nguyen Ngoc Loan executing Viet Cong officer Nguyen Van Lem in Saigon. The photograph's publication in the New York Times rallied US citizens to the anti-war movement and earned Adams a Pulitzer Prize for spot news photography in 1969. The Vietnam War's Tet Offensive had begun on the 30th of January when over 80,000 communist troops carried out a series of surprise attacks against South Vietnamese forces and their allies. It's reported that 2 days later, in the early morning of the 1st of February, Lem led a troop that attacked a South Vietnamese base and killed South Vietnamese National Police officers and their families. He was later captured near a mass grave containing 34 civilian bodies and was soon brought before General Loan in Saigon. While still handcuffed, Loan shot Lem with his Smith & Wesson revolver in front of photographer Eddie Adams and an NBC News television cameraman. The photograph was printed in the New York Times and appeared alongside a now-forgotten image of a child killed by the Viet Cong in an attempt by the paper to achieve some balance. However, the immediacy of the image made an enormous impact in America, where it became strongly associated with the anti-war movement. Adams later spoke out many times in defense of General Loan, declaring that the photograph does not present the whole story. He later visited Loan many times and apologized in person for the effect the photo had had on his life. On hearing of General Loan's death in 1998, Adams referred to him as a hero.
As it went for Hanoi and the chaos of the Tet Offensive, Westmoreland and his staff really, really screwed up. Despite having the ability to gather the best intelligence on the planet, Westmoreland and his staff did not predict. They did not see this coming. They actually believed that the pendulum was finally shifting, that maybe by 69 or 70 at the latest, the United States would be able to draw down and pull out. They thought the enemy was crippled. They thought the enemy lost the initiative. But you know what happens when you get overconfident? You get cocky. You miss details. Again, history allows for hindsight. And later, historians went back and had access to all of the reports and all of the data that was gathered. And apparently there was actual ample evidence that the enemy was planning to do something. But they did not even remotely hint at these being urban attacks, because they never had attacked cities before. Plus, the general assessment was these attacks would be futile. The enemy's not dumb. Why are they going to waste man and materiel on attacks that aren't going to work? But they got lucky. Truth be told, Tet could have been much worse. Down in Saigon, General Frederick C. Wayne happened to be monitoring enemy communications. And he took note in the weeks before Tet of increased VC chatter. He actually convinced Westmoreland to allow him to pull combat units from out of the jungles to wind down their operations and move back into Saigon. In his report, he said, and I quote, "Something is coming that is going to be pretty bad, and it wasn't going to be up to the Laotian border somewhere. It's going to be right in our own backyard." So as a result, even though the VC sent most of its soldiers to Saigon, Saigon was actually better defended than anywhere else in South Vietnam. And had this attack been launched just 2 weeks before, the VC might have been able to take Saigon like they took Hue. But it was just luck that they avoided everything. Questions? The impact of this attack was a game changer. The Americans, generally speaking, trusted their government. They trusted the LBJ administration. They trusted Westmoreland's assessment. They actually believed that the war was winding down, that the enemy was defeated, that the boys would be home in a year or two. So when these events played out on television and in the newspapers, they were truly shocked. But here's the danger. And this is something most people today are just too stupid to understand. You can't pretend to like
one politician or one political party and trust everything they're going to say, but then hate the other side. Because the truth is, both sides lie. And you can't trust the media. Because the media doesn't tell the truth either. The media has an agenda. And the media either supports one party or the other. And the same thing played out in Vietnam. Tet, militarily speaking, was an American win. They beat back the enemy. The VC didn't take a single city. They didn't take a single town. Everywhere they acted, they were driven back. And in a war, if you beat the enemy everywhere, that's a win. But that's not how the media portrayed it. The media sensationalized the coverage. They showed images of guys shooting. They showed images of dead people. They showed images of jets flying over and blowing up neighborhoods. They showed pictures of women and children crying. They actually made it look like the battles were 10 times more severe than they actually were. They made it look like all over South Vietnam there was a full-scale war going on, instead of it being in isolated pockets. And the commentators, they had no idea what was going on. They didn't tell the truth. Again, think of the video we just watched. The photographer who took the picture went on TV and said, no, that's only half the story. But nobody listened. Because perception is reality. If you perceive things as being the way you want them to be, that's the only thing you're going to see. And the media had an axe to grind. They were trying to sensationalize the coverage so they could get more ratings. And they spun Tet as a total disaster. They ignored the facts that didn't fit the narrative. There was not a single story that talked about the fact that for the first time the ARVN actually fought hard to help achieve victory. They didn't talk about how every single enemy unit was smashed. That the enemy, more often than not, retreated the moment that the Allies shot at them. They also basically started labeling Westmoreland as being incompetent. And they disavowed his opinion that Tet was the distraction from Khe Sanh. The worst story was written by syndicated columnist Art Buchwald. Now, if you've never heard of that expression, syndicated columnist, that means it's a reporter who sells his stories and it gets printed in multiple papers. Well, Buchwald, in a story about Westmoreland, portrayed him as being a reincarnation of George Armstrong Custer. And boasting that the Battle of Little Bighorn, we're going to win because the Sioux is on the run. Well, Custer got wiped out at the Battle of Little Bighorn because the Sioux didn't run away. They simply overwhelmed. That's not what was going on in Vietnam. The exact opposite was happening. The U.S. managed to overwhelm the VC. The VC retreated. But again, you hear in the media what you want to hear. So if you put on the news today and you are inclined to like Trump, you're going to go to the sources that make Trump seem like he's the second coming of Jesus Christ. Or if you hate Trump, you're going to go to the sources that also hate Trump, and Trump is going to be the next incarnation of Adolf Hitler. Is Trump either? No. But you couldn't tell that by flipping the channels. In the end, the most significant impact of Tet was that it just reinforced those views of the people who basically thought the war was lost. And again, as a son whose father was in Vietnam at this time, and who has talked to many veterans who fought in the Vietnam War, the soldiers over there did not believe it in 68 or 69. They viewed Tet as a good ass kicking, and they were ripped up and roaring, ready to do it again. But that's not the way things play out. Politicians took advantage of it. Senator Edward Kennedy, the younger brother of former President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. In the Senate, he noted, which was not true, that the fighting was so fierce because the people of South Vietnam had deadly apathy, that they didn't care about the war that was going on. Factually not true. Again, as I've said twice, the ARVN fought hard, and the people of South Vietnam rallied to the ARVN. They didn't want the VC in their villages. That's the reason why the VC didn't take a single inch of land. But that's politics, baby. Politicians say the damnedest things. Because you know, it's not illegal for them to lie. Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia, who happened to be a LBJ ally, told LBJ, and I quote, "We had poor intelligence. We were not prepared for these attacks. We underestimated morale and vitality of the Viet Cong, and we overestimated the support of the South Vietnamese government and its people. Something is wrong over there." So LBJ is getting bashed by the people who don't like him, and he's getting bashed by the people who technically do. The truth, though, and this is the only truth, is that the administration did not see this coming. They believed Westmoreland's reports. As I said last class, by late 67, LBJ stopped listening to counter opinions. He only listened to those people who told him what he wanted to hear. So if the man he has in charge over there is saying, "We're winning," it's the only thing he's going to hear. So he, like many people, didn't see it coming because he had no basis to see it coming. But soon, one by one, all of LBJ's advisors basically started telling the president, "Mr. President, time is running out." And then he got punched in the face. The face of the news, Walter Cronkite, who was viewed by the American people from the late 1950s all the way up until the early 1980s when he finally retired as the face of truth. Not true, he was as biased as the rest of them. You just couldn't tell his bias. But on February 26th, he went on TV and reported live from Vietnam in the midst of Tet. I don't know why I have this clip that has a commercial in it. Man, I didn't look at this one either.
A little differently.
Is there anything substantive here? Oh, there we go.
Tonight, back in more familiar surroundings in New York, we'd like to sum up our findings in Vietnam, an analysis that must be speculative, personal, subjective. Who won and who lost in the great Tet Offensive against the cities? I'm not sure. The Viet Cong did not win by a knockout, but neither did we. The referees of history may make it a draw. Another standoff may be coming in the big battles expected south of the demilitarized zone. Quezon could welcome with a terrible loss in American lives, prestige, and morale. And this is a tragedy of our stubbornness there. But the bastion no longer is a key to the rest of the northern regions, and it is doubtful that the American forces can be defeated across the breadth of the DMZ with any substantial loss of ground. Another standoff. On the political front, past performance gives no confidence that the Vietnamese government can cope with its problems, now compounded by the attack on the cities. It may not fall, it may hold on, but it probably won't show the dynamic qualities demanded of this young nation. Another standoff. We have been too often disappointed by the optimism of the American leaders, both in Vietnam and Washington, who have faith any longer in the silver linings they find in the darkest clouds. They may be right that Hanoi's winter spring offensive has been forced by the communist realization that they could not win the longer war of attrition, but the communists hope that any success in the offensive will improve their position for eventual negotiations. It would improve their position, and it would also require our realization that we should have had all along, that any negotiations must be that, negotiations, not the dictation of peace terms. For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This summer's almost certain standoff will either end in real give and take negotiations or terrible escalation. And for every means we have to escalate, the enemy can match us. And that applies to invasion of the North, the use of nuclear weapons, or the mere commitment of 100 or 200 or 300,000 more American troops to the battle. And with each escalation, the world comes closer to the brink of cosmic disaster. To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance that military and political analysts are right, in the next few months, we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victims, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite.
Now, by the way, the story itself, the total, was about a half hour, maybe 37 minutes. But when that piped into the homes of 20 million Americans, particularly where Cronkite said, and I quote, "It is more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate." It was said that LBJ, who was watching in the White House, turned to his aides and said very simply, "If I lost Cronkite, I lost Middle America." Prior to this broadcast, Cronkite always said the war was winnable, it was only a matter of time. But for the first time, February 26th, 1968, we're not going to. As popular support began to dwindle, LBJ announced a change in Vietnam policy. First, on March 23rd, he announced that General Westmoreland was stepping down as commander of U.S. forces in South Vietnam. He was coming back to the United States, and he was going to get promoted to the Army Chief of Staff. FYI, when Westmoreland came home officially on June 9th, he was the second general in American history not to receive a triumphal parade. The first was MacArthur, actually, after Truman fired him in Korea. Westmoreland was replaced by General Creighton Abrams. Abrams, of which the M1 Abrams tank is named after, the modern U.S. battle tank, he was a U.S. tank commander in World War II. He also served and fought in Korea. And many believed he was the smartest man in the Army. He announced a 360, now 180, from Westmoreland's Americanization of the war. Abrams' first press briefing, he announced his approach would be the Vietnamization of the war. Westmoreland talked about body counts as proof of the direction of the war. Westmoreland also focused on big unit operations. But Abrams said no more. We're going to shift back to the way it was during JFK. We're going to go back to ARVN operations. And the U.S. is going to support them. Abrams also said he was going to focus on protecting the population. So, instead of randomly going out into villages, we're going to try to protect the villages. And we're also going to try to sever the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Then on March 31st, LBJ announces he was going to end the bombing of North Vietnam. Now, while LBJ presented the idea as a humanitarian one, truth be told, the devastation had already occurred. Going back to the launching of Operation Rolling Thunder in 1964, this operation, which was supposed to last for 6 months, lasted for 43 months. And the stats are awesome. In the truest sense of the word. Over 350,000 missions were flown. The United States would drop over 655,000 tons of bombs over North Vietnam. But the U.S. also lost 918 planes and 818 U.S. airmen were killed. But it's estimated we killed close to 200,000 North Vietnamese civilians and managed to hit just about every single significant military structure they had in the North. But of course, we really don't know how many people actually died because the North Vietnamese didn't keep statistics. But when the moment this announcement was made, LBJ received a surprising note through diplomatic channels. Hanoi, for the first time, expressed an interest into possibly opening talks aimed at achieving a settlement of the war. Now, it took several months for both sides even to agree where to meet. In the end, they agreed they would meet in Paris. Talks began mid-May 1968. But the talks deadlocked. Because the North Vietnamese didn't want to sit directly next to the government of South Vietnam, and they wanted the NLF to be involved, but Saigon didn't want to sit next to LVF, and they wanted to sit to the left. They spent 7 months arguing over where they were going to sit. So even though the talks began, they were not concluded. But truth be told, it's great that LBJ had this sudden shift. But it was too little too late for him politically, and in hopes of ending the war by 1970. FYI, 1968 had the highest death rate of the entire war. 16,899 men lost their lives in Vietnam. So why was it too little too late? Well, 1968 was also an election year. And every 4 years, like clockwork, these United States of America elect a leader of our country. And unfortunately for LBJ, now by the way, under the 22nd Amendment, which created the two-term limits, LBJ could have ran in 68. Yes, he became president upon the death of JFK, but he died less than 2 years from the next election. Under the 22nd Amendment, that basically allowed him to run for a second term. But had he become president more than 2 years, he would have been term limited. So he could have ran. He was thinking about running until the Democrats, his own party, launched a Dump Johnson campaign. Leading the charge was Senator Eugene McCarthy, Democrat from Minnesota. He had long been a vocal anti-war voice in the Senate. Well, he announced in late February he was going to run for the presidency. By the way, white, college-educated, anti-war activists rallied to his cause. But then, in a double blow, 2 weeks later, Johnson's nemesis, Bobby Kennedy, announced he was going to run for the presidency. Bobby Kennedy got support from minority voters, as well as anti-war groups. So the activists went to McCarthy, but the groups went to Kennedy. Having these two big names running in the primaries, Johnson knew he didn't stand a chance. So he would go on the television and make this announcement. That's his wife, that's his daughter.
With America's sons in the fields far away. With America's future under challenge right here at home. With our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day. I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other and the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not see, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
That was it. He went on the news and he made that announcement.
That was the first time in the history of the United States,
a president of the United States, who could have ran,
went into people's homes and basically made the announcement that he was done.
But that was a game changer. Because with the president out, now it was a free-for-all. So, shortly after LBJ announces he's not running, others jump in, causing the Democrat Party to fracture. In April, Vice President Hubert Humphrey announced his candidacy. Now, Humphrey was a party insider, so he got the support of the union bosses in the inner cities. Now, interestingly enough, Humphrey didn't even campaign because there was no need to. Unlike today, where all 50 states have primaries, in the 1968 presidential election, only 13 states had primaries. And all of the party bosses basically threw their support behind Humphrey. But that didn't stop others from throwing their hat in the ring. Governor George Wallace, Democrat of Alabama, he proclaimed himself to be the law and order candidate. Although, truth be told, he spearheaded the white Southern Democrats who were angry at LBJ for ending segregation. So, he actually decided to run as a third party candidate when it was clear that the Democrat Party wouldn't endorse him. So he ran under the mantle of the American Independent Party. He got a lot of support of those boys in the Klan, that's for sure. Now, even though there are only 13 primaries, McCarthy and Kennedy did actually run. They actually campaigned. And they constantly denounced the war. They attacked the blind war hawks. They called for a total bombing halt in all of Vietnam, north and south. And they actually urged that the Viet Cong get a seat at the table, that they should be allowed to participate in a post-war government. McCarthy also attacked the Cold War mentality, going so far as even to rip JFK, the dead president, for getting us into the war to begin with. Well, Bobby Kennedy obviously rose to refute the attacks on his dead brother, But neither Kennedy nor McCarthy were enough to overcome the backdoor dealings of Humphrey's campaign. And it never even got to the convention. Because on June 4th, shortly before the announcing of the outcome of the California primary, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, shot by Sirhan Sirhan at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. He would die 25 hours later after being shot. Now, here's an interesting thing to show you that history is always ongoing. Sirhan was a Palestinian who was angry at the fact that RFK gave support to Israel. Shot him dead. Of course, the irony was is that RFK was in second place behind Humphrey. So if it would have gotten to convention, it's possible that RFK would have been the candidate. And if he would have been the candidate, it's possible he might have won. But we'll never know because he was dead. Another interesting event that erupted during the 1968 convention election is what took place at the Democrat convention in Chicago. Thousands of anti-war activists descended upon the convention. The protest turned violent, and the Chicago police responded by using clubs and tear gas to beat back or to arrest the protesters, leaving many of them bloodied up. And all of this was covered on TV. And Americans were shocked to see the police brutally beating the anti-war protesters. The hippies, the poor hippies. But in the end, the outcome of the DNC was predetermined. And Humphrey would receive the nomination to be the Democrat candidate in the general election. While the Democrats were divided, the Republicans were not. On the Republican side, there was collegiality. There were four candidates. What time yet? Still got half hour. Scared of a little bee?
No, it was like two or three big wasps in the window.
Are you allergic? You guys allergic?
No, sir.
Well, I was going to say gal, too, but it's more looking at the guys that were looking a little nervous in the back.
Oh, I would just prefer not to say it.
All right, who was running on the Republican side? Well, the leading candidate was former Vice President Richard Milhouse Nixon. He was joined by then California Governor Ronald Reagan, as well as Governor Nelson Rockefeller, Republican of New York, and Governor George Romney, father of Mitt Romney, Republican Governor of Michigan. Well, Reagan actually did really well among primary voters. Reagan was a master speaker. But Nixon had been working tirelessly since the 1964 election, boosting Republicans all across the country. Nixon was personally attributed with helping the House flip many seats. The Republicans would pick up 47 seats in the 66 midterm elections. He also would help 8 Republicans flip the governorships. But there was concern because Nixon did lose to Kennedy in 60. And Nixon did lose his attempt to become governor of California in 62. But Nixon was clever. He originally was hawkish on the war, frequently criticizing LBJ initially for not doing enough to win. But he went to the center when Tet erupted. his biggest move out on the campaign trail. He called for a pause on the war, called for a moratorium in hopes of giving an opportunity for both sides to take the negotiation table. So, for a growing majority of Americans who were becoming angry with the war but wanted to see us not lose, he seemed reasonable. And as a result, at the Republican convention, he was nominated on the first ballot overwhelmingly. And then in a general election, his campaign motto was very simple: progressive de-Americanization. So we're not just going to pull out and run. We're going to slowly shift the war from being an American war to a Vietnamese war. He also called for a program for peace, but not a peace at any price. He also was against, and I quote, the camouflage surrender of legitimate U.S. or allied interests. As he said, he wanted a peace with honor. And as a result, he ran a really well-run, organized campaign. He managed to exploit voter unease about the direction of the nation. Not only did he talk about an honorable peace, but he also talked about ending the draft. And he encouraged the ratification of the 26th Amendment, which would lower the voting age down to 18. His competitor, Humphrey, his campaign was a mess. It was disorganized, it was underfunded. And because Humphrey was more hawkish than McCarthy or Kennedy had been, he was constantly targeted by angry war protesters. Now, he tried separating himself from LBJ, but a vice president can't separate themselves from the president. Just like Kamala couldn't separate herself from Biden. The voters see them both as being one and the same. So as a result, he would fall short. As you know, when an election happens, we hear two things. We hear about the popular vote. And in the popular vote, it was close. Nixon got 31.7 million votes to Humphrey's 31.3. The irony was that Wallace, running as a third party, siphoned 9.9 million votes. If he didn't run, it's possible Humphrey would have won. But because Wallace ran, he took Democrat votes away, allowing Nixon to eke by. But truth be told, presidents don't win because of the popular vote. Presidents win in the Electoral College. And Nixon won convincingly. 301 electoral votes to Humphrey's 191 to Wallace's 46. Why did Nixon win? Well, he was the only candidate that appeared to have a plan on ending the war. And as it turned out, Nixon, regardless of what you heard about him, is best credited with being the man who got us out of Vietnam. In his inaugural speech, there were two quotes that I just want to read to you because they are significant. The first, and I quote, "The greatest honor history can bestow is the title of peacemaker. This honor now beckons America, the chance to help lead the world at last out of the valley of turmoil and onto that high ground of peace that man has dreamed of since the dawn of civilization." So on one hand, praise be the peacemakers. And on the other, he also stated, and I quote, "America cannot and will not conceive all the plans, design all the programs, execute all the decisions, and undertake all of the defense of the free nations of the world." What Nixon was doing was directly countering JFK's call for the United States to be the world police. Nixon knew we couldn't be everywhere. Nixon also knew that the Americans didn't have the means, financially, or with manpower, to be everywhere. And he had no intention on fighting the Cold War through the prism of the domino theory or containment. He also knew the United States could not win Vietnam. And he was determined not to be the first POTUS to lose a war. So, we're not going to be the world's police. We can't win the war, but we don't want to lose it. How are you going to achieve this? Well, he fully embraced what Abrams called the Vietnamization of the war, but Nixon referred to as the de-Americanization of the war. Essentially, we would go back to the strategy that JFK had us engaged in, actually going as far back as Eisenhower. In other words, the United States is going to go back to training and equipping the ARVN. And it's going to be the ARVN that does the ground fighting. But simultaneously, he's also going to try to use diplomacy to get Hanoi to the bargaining table. Nixon would do the unthinkable. He would work to open up diplomatic channels with Moscow and Beijing. This was counter to anything LBJ ever did. Because Nixon, being a great diplomat, realized if you could get Moscow and Beijing to stop supporting Hanoi, Hanoi can't fight. The money, the bullets, the guns, they're all coming from either Russia or China. If Nixon could take that away, the North Vietnamese would not be able to fight anymore. And by the way, during his administration, Nixon would meet with the leaders, not only of the Soviet Union, but he would also travel to China And it was Nixon who first opened up China to trade relations with the United States. But Nixon didn't do it alone. As national security advisor to the president, Nixon would tap Henry Kissinger. Kissinger was a Harvard professor who shared Nixon's view on foreign policy. Both men realized this Cold War that we've been engaged in since Truman, it's not going to win. We're not going to turn the Cold War into a hot war. And if we turn it into a hot war, there is going to be what is known as MAD. You're probably not familiar with the term MAD. I learned about MAD in elementary school. Mutual Assured Destruction. Nixon and Kissinger realized that if the Cold War becomes a hot war, China has nukes, Russia has nukes, we have nukes, we're going to blow the world to smithereens. So why don't we see if we can engage in diplomacy and settle the tensions? But how are you going to do it? Well, they would utilize a maneuver that Kissinger referred to as linkage. Essentially, we're going to cooperate with the communists in terms of economic and strategic matters. One of the things that Nixon did was actually have two dedicated lines installed in the White House. These phone lines, one went to Moscow, one went to Beijing. So at any given moment, the President of the United States could pick up the phone and talk to whoever was in charge in Moscow or whoever was in charge in Beijing. And what did they talk about? Economic trade deals. Denuclearization treaties. World forums. Anything to avoid escalation that could result in conflict. Now why? Nixon knew the country was tapped out. There was a Gallup poll taken in February 14, 1969. 35% of the American people felt an immediate withdrawal from Vietnam would be appropriate. Just pull out. Now, by the way, that was up from 21% in the poll that was taken in October. Nixon literally read the tea leaves. He could see the way the pendulum was going. And even more shockingly, for the first time in that same poll, the numbers flipped. Prior to that February 69 poll, there were always more Americans that thought it was better that we were in Vietnam than not. But in this poll, it switched to 51-49, saying that Vietnam was a mistake. Well, if you don't have the support of the American people, even if you're president of the United States, you can't win. And Nixon also knew that the strategy of trying to bomb North Vietnam to the table was also not going to work. He believed that if he could stop the bombing, that maybe Hanoi would grow tired of the war and would seek political sentiment. But as we're going to see next class after we come back from break, he would get a wake-up call real quick that the North Vietnamese was still in the game. So I'm going to give you some stats and then we'll call it a day. When Nixon took the oath of office, U.S. strength in country was the highest that it had been in the war. There were over 534,000 soldiers in country. And the death toll in total during LBJ's years as president ticked over 37,000. When he became president, U.S. strategy was unchanged. U.S. was slowly moving towards Vietnamization. And the ARVN was slowly moving towards combat operations. But another interesting thing began to appear in presidential briefings. First showing up on February 2nd, 1969, there were reports reaching the president that troop morale began to fray. There were reports of incidents known as fragging. Fragging is situations where the enlisted men kill a superior officer because they refuse to engage in following orders. It was typically done by simply taking a grenade, because the United States used fragment grenades, and simply rolling it into a captain or a lieutenant's tent, killing them with shrapnel. Three were reported in January. By the end of 1969, that number had exceeded 46 more, putting it at 49 for the year. If the men were more inclined to kill their officers to fight, there's a problem. And I can finish. One last little clunk chunk, and then we're done for the day. And what about negotiations? The negotiations that LBJ started. Well, as I said, they were inching forward. By the time Nixon became president, they finally figured out the seating arrangements. The way they would do it, Saigon would be on one side of the table, the North Vietnamese would be on the other side of the table, but the table would be angled as such. It was so bizarre. Be angled this way, would be angled this way, and the representatives of the VC would be here. So that way the South Vietnamese could look across and look at the North Vietnamese, but they wouldn't have to look at the VC. It took them 7 months to figure that out. LBJ initially tapped Henry Cabot Lodge, brought him back from retirement. Former ambassador to South Vietnam, going all the way back to Kennedy. LBJ would entrust him to negotiate, and when Nixon came on board, Lodge reported his progress. Seriously. There were no formal talks yet, but apparently Lodge had met with a chief negotiator from Hanoi 11 times, taking tea. But the response was always the same. Hanoi would not negotiate unless the United States agreed to withdraw militarily and basically allow the Vietnams to negotiate the outcome. That was the line in the sand. And last but not least, at the same time the administration started trying to move on breaking apart the support. Also in February 1969, Kissinger would secretly reach out to Moscow, asking for Moscow to kind of force the North Vietnamese to the negotiating table. But Moscow simply admitted to Kissinger, "We have no control over them. Talk to the Chinese." So, we have a new president, we have a new plan, we have an American people tired. The exhaustion of the war, the chaos of Tet, and now we're trying to figure out a way to get out peace with honor. Would Nixon be able to achieve it? Well, no spoilers, we'll deal with that when we come back from Easter break. In case you were not aware, Thursday there is no class because it's Holy Thursday. So you will be going home for Easter break, and then we will come back on Tuesday. And on Tuesday, your papers are due. So hopefully at this point, you're almost done. Remember what I've said multiple times. You will be graded based upon my grading system that's on proflomatic.com in the paper section. And if you read it all the way through, do the math. It's possible to end up with a negative grade. Don't be the first person this term to get a negative grade. I always have one. I will grade you according to that curve. So, do your best to put together a good paper. Follow all the directions. Don't lose student points. And don't cheat. With the Chicago method, there's no need to even cheat. Anything you borrow, just put a footnote in. You'll be fine. All right? Yes.
If we have any questions, like over here, can we email you?
Send me an email. I'll do my best to be available. I may not be online every day, but I'll do my best to at least check
in.
Yep. Have a nice Easter.